Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 15 to 24. Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, for ye saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest ye corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of any male or female, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged fowl that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creepeth on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. And lest thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldst be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven. But the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people of inheritance, as ye are this day. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes, and aware that I should not go over Jordan, and that I should not go in unto that good land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. But I must die in this land, I must not go over Jordan, but ye shall go over and possess that good land. Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. And so we're going to be thinking together this morning about something that I couldn't say I've ever heard a sermon preached on it. At least if I did, I don't remember it. God as a consuming fire. I've heard plenty of sermons on the love of God, and I've preached them, and I believe in it most profoundly. And I shall continue to preach the love of God. But seldom have I heard anyone address this very biblical description of this one true triune God. Our God is a consuming fire, and what that means. Or to put it another way, we're given in this text that Moses was speaking to the people of Israel shortly before they would cross over Jordan and begin to inherit the promised land. He is getting them ready for a holy, prosperous life in the nation, or the boundaries that the Lord is giving them by his plan, by his grace. And Moses is telling them that the major thing he wants them to remember when they go into that new country is the transcendence of God, the pure spirituality of God. If they will remember that our God is a consuming, holy fire, they and their children — we're going to speak of the children next Sunday, or the next time I'm here, 2 Sundays — they and their children can be blessed indeed. So this little passage from verse 15 to 24 of Deuteronomy chapter 4 sets before us what the transcendent purity of God requires of us, his people. And I want to say this to you. Some may have thoughts, well, this was spoken by Moses maybe 1450 BC, something like that. That's 3,000 400 years ago. What about today? Well, I mentioned on Monday night at the prayer meeting for rain from the book of Hebrews, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. That our God changes not. Book of Isaiah is full of it. God's holiness, His purity, and His existence both in beautiful, wonderful love and as a pure, consuming fire has never changed in the slightest. And we must always deal with who God is in order to make it. So just four little points this morning from this text. First point is God's revelation of His purity. That's in verse 15. God reveals Himself as a, as it says in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, a most pure spirit. And in the Child's Catechism, it says, you know, the question, what is God? And the child answers, God is a spirit and hath not a body like men. And naturally, we live in a world of bodies. Bodies are good. They're made by God, and it's a wonderful housing for our soul or our spirit, the body, spirit, body, or soul-body connection. It's a mystery. But because everybody that we see is in the flesh, we might tend to think that the only thing that is real is that which is material. And that something cannot live unless it has a body. That's not true. I think that's one reason some people that are not Christians or don't, maybe they go to some kind of church, but they don't really have a biblical understanding why they feel such despair at the death of a loved one, because they say, well, the body is not working. We have to bury it under the ground, and so that's all there is to my husband, my wife, my parents, or whatever. That's a terrible mistake to think that. There's nothing wrong with feeling sad over death. It's perfectly legitimate. Jesus wept, but to think that the only thing is real is that which is material, it's one of the greatest mistakes you could make. Because the prime reality is Almighty Eternal God. In Genesis 1, He creates all things out of nothing by the word of His power. God always was. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, dwelling in light and love and purity and consuming fire indeed. He's so bright and beautiful. So, material things had a beginning. Not everybody's going to agree on this, but it seems to me that the Bible teaches, and science certainly doesn't go against it, real science, that the created order maybe goes back 6,000 years or something. I can't prove it, but I believe that's about right. A few thousand years, whatever, we've had bodies. But as you thought, for countless eons of eons of eons before there was a created order, before there were sun, moon, stars, galaxies, planets, and there were no bodies, either luminous bodies in the heavens nor a terrestrial body, this earth, nor physical bodies of animals, or you could call a plant a body, I don't know, and men and women. God always was. God is a most pure spirit. Now, he chose to create bodies. They're there for his glory and for our benefit. But what we have to remember when we come back to who God is that he transcends his creation. The basis, in my opinion, of modernism, of the liberal theology, which destroyed so many churches and is still laying them waste, is to think that God is not bigger than his creation, that he is bound and limited by nature and by the created order. Once you think that, eventually everything is gone and the Bible is thrown out the doors of the church and the university. But God is transcendent. He always was. And then at a certain point, several thousand years ago, I reckon, he brings this wonderful cosmos into being. But God remains a pure, holy, burning, bright, beautiful spiritual reality, even more real than the material. Material decays after the fall of Adam and goes back into the dust, and in every change of energy, the second law of thermodynamics, some goes in a non-reversible heat energy, things decay, things break down, they're no longer there. But the most pure, holy, bright, glorious Spirit of God is always there, always the same, so he's more real than anything else. Now, when God shows us who he shows us something about himself by the created order, the sun, the moon, the stars. They declare his glory. They tell us something about God's handiwork, certainly they do, Psalm 19, Psalm 8, Genesis 1, and the rest of it. But when God reveals who he himself is, it is always not by using elements from the created order. God reveals himself to be spirit. And that's what verse 15 is saying at Mount Sinai or Horeb. The holy fire of God has set that whole mountain alight with no doubt frightening flames mounting up to the skies. And out of that mountain they heard a voice. God speaks, but he doesn't show himself by means of animals or stars or anything else. God, who is spirit, has a voice, he has a mind, he has a personality, the prime personality, and he speaks words from that mountain. That's who God is. He's a most pure spirit, but he's real. He's a real person, indeed, three persons in one. He talks, he communicates. Jesus Christ is the Logos, the Word. And that Word comes from the mountain. Now, we don't see, some of you have been to the Holy Land, I haven't, and I don't think they know exactly where Mount Sinai really is, but there's an ancient monastery, St. Catherine's, that claims it's on Mount Sinai. That may be true. I don't know. But even so, if St. Catherine's monastery, where one of the ancient manuscripts of the Bible was discovered years ago, if that is Mount Sinai, you don't see the holy flames leaping up to heaven. You don't hear God's voice speaking, but you've got it in the book. We can get in touch with who God is through the words of the book. And the book hasn't changed. So God shows himself as a pure spirit. And it's said here in verse 15 and on down, I did not manifest myself in the body of any creature. I did not show myself to be some kind of animal, or even the sun or the moon or the Milky Way. All you heard was this voice and saw this holy consuming fire, pure holiness. That's been the evil of the world religions from ancient times to modern times, that they want to reduce God to some element of the created order. So the second commandment, no graven image of any animal is allowable in the church or in Christian worship, or before that in the synagogue, the temple, the tabernacle. No graven image of any kind of animal to worship God. But in ancient Egypt, they worshiped the sun god Amun-Re, and in Mesopotamia, where Abraham came from, they worshiped the lunar god, the moon. You know, when the children of Israel committed sin in the wilderness, Moses was up on the mountain, they made a golden calf, represent God as a calf, but he didn't do that. He said that's forbidden. And Dagon of the Philistines was a fish god. And in Egypt and in India to this day, some worship the cobra snake as a god. Things like that. And so that's forbidden in verses 16 to 18. No making of graven images. No thinking that God comes down in the body of an animal. That tells you nothing about God. Oh, and he's a great creator, tells you that. And then in verse 19, it says that you're not to worship any of the elements of nature. Some nations, with a faith, Egypt with the sun, and the Mesopotamians with the moon and so forth, tried to say, well, that's God, or those are gods up in the skies, in the atmosphere, the stellar heavens, that's maybe God. And the word says, no, that's not God. That's something he made for his glory. But God is a pure spirit, transcendent to everything he made, not limited by anything he made. You might say, well, look, you're preaching against ancient Egyptian religion or modern religion in India, but that's not us. Well, let me read you something. I suppose one of the men who's considered himself one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century, big atheist from a famous family in England, Sir Julian Huxley, as I remember, he was high up somewhere in the United Nations, the educational wing of it. And Sir Julian Huxley wrote an essay that I read once in 1966 entitled The Humanist Frame. Now, he's supposed to be one of the smartest men in the world at that time, in the mid-20th century, Sir Julian Huxley. Highly honored, published all these books from a distinguished, wealthy family. They're big atheists. And he was thought to be the bright one. He says in The Humanist Frame that we must reject, quote, the God hypothesis. That's what he calls it. The God hypothesis must be rejected. But when somebody rejects the transcendent God, what is the first thing they always do? People can't live without something in the place of God. They make a substitute. So here this man, Julian Huxley, you read The Humanist Frame, 1966, page 113. He says this: what man should worship is the universe, and I quote him exactly, seen as a unitary and evolutionary process. You know why some people get so upset if you criticize evolution? Why do they get that upset? I'm supposed to be interviewed. They're making a series on television. I reckon it'll come out, I don't know, on Friday in Charlotte on some of these issues. Particularly, I'm obviously giving you the creationist end of the thing. And what I know is, and I've been in debates, one about a year ago, and people that hold to evolution can become very, very distraught and infuriated if you even give scientific reasons, not give them the doctrine, give scientific reasons like something wrong with evolution. It's terribly upset. Why? You've got to understand that they may have never read Sir Julian Huxley, I don't know, but Huxley presents something that's been widely abroad in Western culture for 150 years. Some form of the evolutionary process is about the only God a lot of people have. The things are changing, they're evolving, we're part of it, it may get better, we hope it's going to get better, it's getting higher, and that explains everything, and then as far as we worship anything, it's the evolutionary process, and then you start criticizing evolution, you're criticizing their God. They don't take it kindly, but I'm going to keep doing it, I can tell you that much. Say here, you know, one little application before I go any further. Now I think that the value of Christian education may have many values. I assume it does, but one of the things that my wife and I discussed when our first child was maybe 2-3 years old, we were reading a lot of things on the whole issue of education, and we felt like at the basis of education there needs to be some kind of commitment, or at least ability to speak of the highest reality of all, God, and that He's a creator. And so we felt like we didn't want to put children where they would be exposed to evolution as the final proof. Now realize in Christian schools you've got a lot of really excellent teachers, and in public schools you've got a lot of good Christian teachers. My wife once taught in public school, my mother and my grandmother and so forth, but it's difficult for the Christian sometimes in the maybe the state schools where there's less freedom to speak of what they really believe in of creation. And many of the textbooks, I'm told, won't explain everything in terms of what Julian Huxley says is quote, the God with a small g of humanism, namely the evolutionary process. So that's why we decided that whatever else we did with the money we had, limited funds, would go to seek to give the children as good a Christian education as we would be able to do. And that is one reason I've been a strong supporter from the beginning to the here locally, the Dillon Christian School. Great thing to teach. Who isn't God? Evolution is questionable scientifically, I believe. A lot of good people hold to it. I'm not denouncing the character. But it's not God. I'm not even sure it's true. I don't think it is. But how one says it's not God. God is God. He's a pure pure spirit and made everything else. And that is the basis of your understanding of how the world works. Tremendous advantage for children and young people, and I'm glad we went that route. So, first, God's revelation of His purity, and then secondly, the demands of His purity for our worship and our thinking that I just talked about, verses 16 and 19. And then thirdly, true remembrance of our history. This passage in Deuteronomy is mostly dealing with what you think about. Ever thought of that? That's very important. It's important in the New Testament, you know, and whatsoever things are true, lovely, of good report, think on these things. And the book of Deuteronomy, as I've been studying it afresh, has a great deal to say about what you think about the thought life, of how important that is to the quality of who you are as a man or a woman, how you think. And this section of Deuteronomy 4 is very important of how we think, remembering God is a pure transcendent spirit and needs to be worshipped in a way that does not involve idols and natural objects and pictorial representations. And then it goes on in verses 20 to 23, how we think about our history, what you remember. What you remember is very, very important in shaping how you live each day. And that, to me, is one of the tragedies. I've had one or two family members that got Alzheimer's, and I never realized before that time that I was in the house with somebody that had Alzheimer's, couldn't remember anything. I mean, the more it went, the worse it got. And I wrote in my diary one day after a particularly frustrating incident with this relative, I've never known how much of our life lies in the memory. If you forget who you are, whoever member of the family is, where you are, I wouldn't say you totally lost your life, because you can still survive physically for possibly a few years at a certain level, but you've lost the kind of the joy of life. Now, I know a Christian, God is with them, and they're going to be in His presence, so it's all right. But the memory is extremely important to what you are and how you act and what you hope for. And Moses says in verses 20 to 23, it's very important that you remember your history as the people of God. Remember where you've come from, and thus you'll have some concept as to where you are going. In verse 20, he says, God brought you, as the children of Israel, out of the iron furnace. They were in the horrid oppression of Egypt as slaves who were being beaten and abused, and God got them out. Moses said, don't you ever forget it. And that is the reason that the feast of the Passover was instituted to be celebrated every spring by the Jewish people, that they would always remember that God had brought them by blood, by power, out of the iron furnace. And the feast of the Passover for the church in the New Testament was fulfilled in and replaced by the Lord's Supper. And God had said we should regularly celebrate the Lord's Supper. And we remember in the Lord's Supper what the Jewish people remember in the Passover, that God has redeemed us by blood, by power, out of the iron furnace, out of hell, out of our sinful self-destructiveness, out of egocentrism. God, by His mighty power and what He did in His incarnate Son, has redeemed us forevermore. And we remember that in the Lord's Supper. So remembrance is very, very important. And He speaks about how the Lord divided the world among the nations and allotted them particular boundaries. It talks about that in the Acts of the Apostles, and here in verse 19 it talks about God dividing up the nations. I'm not sure what that means, but I think at least it means when the world was destroyed by the flood and Noah and his three sons and their wives survived in the ark and land on Mount Ararat, which is somewhere Armenia, Turkey, this high mountain. And they came out, and in the of the three different sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all the nations of the world come. And you can find out more about that in Genesis 10 and in other places. And so God was at work sending some of the tribes of we who are of European extraction, British extraction, our tribe, Japheth group, started moving into Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and some went into, the ones of Ham went into Egypt and to Africa, and Shem, that's the Israelites, and possibly the Chinese, it's a little difficult to know, went in these various directions, and God was concerned with that, and God was preparing the world for redemption, which would come out of Jerusalem in the fullness of the time. But now, the point that's made here is especially in verse 20, that God chose a particular nation as His inheritance. He chose the Jews. He chose Abraham and the seed of Abraham. On down, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and through the years, and later the seed of David, and so forth. God chose them among all others that they would be the line of salvation to the rest of the nations. He would bless them in a particular way, and eventually He would send His own beloved Son to be a Jew, while remaining God, to fulfill all of the Old Testament and to do for us as Gentiles and as Jews what we could never do for ourselves. Now I want you to say a word about this matter that God's people are His inheritance. Now, anybody knows what an inheritance is? I know a man, a friend, and wife had a relative to die not long ago, and apparently I assume this man was well off, and I said, elderly man, do you know if your wife will get any inheritance out of this rather large estate of a man that didn't have any children? He said, I don't know, he got the slightest idea. Well, she will if she won't. But some of you have had phone calls from a law office and say you're in a will, or you've had a letter sent to you, you're in a will. I guess I have two or three times, not massive amount, but I was glad for anything. And many of you, how you have your land or whatever you have, we've all probably got a little bit by inheritance. So inheritance is something that we value. We don't have much, but we keep a few things in safety deposit box of the bank. That's inheritance passed down over the generations. Different things, rings, gold coins, and a few little things. It wouldn't be of high monetary value, but it would be of great sentiment. It's a part of an inheritance, and naturally we treasure it as you would a worldly thing. But now, do you know what God treasures? This is amazing. If it wasn't in the Bible, we wouldn't believe it. God treasures His people. You and I take care of land. If we got any sense, we would put gold coins or beautiful things in a safe place that we have to defend. Sure we would. God's treasure is His people. Now, think of the transcendent God, the most pure spirit, where He is in heaven. We've got some descriptions of heaven. Streets of gold. I'll take that literally. Beautiful green fields, crystal sea, harps of angels ringing the most marvelous music, and the transcended saints up there, and the angels singing together, and evidently, I don't know what the mansions in heaven look like. Some say they're very tall, imposing, most stupendous architecture you've ever seen. I guess that's right. We'll find out. I'm not being dogmatic that I know something I don't know, but heaven is a beautiful, wonderful place. Rainbow circle throne. Must be stupendous. I can't even come up with words to begin to describe it. Even the outworkings of it, the outer edge of it. I can't describe it. And yet, the Bible says, this text says, if I could put it this way, if we could take all the value of the gold in the streets of the New Jerusalem. I read a book on heaven by a man named Randy Alcorn that I recently written. I enjoyed it very much, and he's trying to figure out something about the size of the New Jerusalem and the rest of the renewed cosmos, and I guess he's right. I don't know, but how many thousands of miles of streets, he said, there would be in the heavenly city. And that's just one place among many. And if there's thousands of miles of streets, and they're the most beautiful, pure gold, the world wouldn't be worth that much. You can take the whole world. Stock market. They couldn't come up enough to pay for gold in the street. But God treasures far more than the gold He has laid in His creative, wondrous work in the streets of heaven. He treasures one little humble sinner, one penitent man or woman. May God be merciful to meet a sinner. Thank you, sinner. What little I have is yours. God treasures that more than the little things. Truly, God is different from ourselves, isn't He? He has a different set of facts from the world, and even from us Christians on many occasions. And so God is transcendent. He made all these things out of nothing, total charge of it. He's not to be represented as an animal or as a star or as any created thing. And yet, for all His transcendence, God is very, very close. He is very, very near. In the theological word, God's transcendent, but He's also imminent. He's right here. Now, this transcendent God was so close that He heard the cries of the people of Israel when they were in the iron furnace in Egypt, and he got them out. He got into a political situation, a military situation, and he did everything right to get them out. He sent plagues. He divided the Red Sea. And then when he got his people out into the wilderness, he provided quail for them to eat. He sent manna from heaven to sustain them when there was nothing else. He sent water out of the rock. And then when they sinned and complained bitterly and snakes were sent to bite them, he told Moses, lift up a brass serpent, and if they'd look to that and repent, he would heal them, and he healed them. And when they wouldn't obey and go in, 40 years later, he gives them a second chance. God was that close. God's that involved. If his people are his treasure, you know he's intensely involved in everything that happens to him. If this were a testimony meeting, which is not, maybe be good if it were, we could tell that God has brought us out of some iron furnace. God's providential care in our lives, we couldn't be here if he hadn't done certain things that were beyond our ability to handle. Yes, he let us go through some pain. But God has handled us as his precious treasure, which is why we're here now. And then a fourth point, briefly. A holy warning is given us in verses 22 to 24. A holy warning given us in verses 22 to 24. First of all, is the example of Moses. Moses displeased the Lord at a certain stage, and I've talked about that before. I'm not going into it, but God said, dear Moses, I'll let you look over into the promised land, but you can't go in. You're going to have to die in the wilderness. And Moses reminds them of that. Why? To say, if you don't keep in mind the spirituality and the transcendence and the holiness of God and make that the center of your thinking and worship, you will not be able to keep the land. The land will be taken from you. It will spew you out. And then there's a reason attached. Our God, or it says here, the Lord thy God, verse 24, the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even jealous God. Now, that is exactly quoted in Hebrews chapter 12. If there were time, I would read from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 to 29. There's not time. Taking the same thing, Mount Sinai, God not showing any similitude, but the holy fire is burning, and God's voice is speaking. And then in verse 29 of Hebrews 12, quoting exactly with one or two little minor changes from Deuteronomy 4, for our God is a consuming fire. And immediately before that, we're given the commandment. Serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. And so Hebrews takes us back to Mount Sinai. It adds one thing, that Jesus is the mediator in verse 24. Moses is in a sense a mediator, but an imperfect one. He sinned and couldn't go into the land. Jesus is the perfect mediator. He bears in his own body our sins on the tree, and he leads us into the land. Son of God becomes flesh while remaining God. Dies for our sin. Is raised in a new body to give us eternal life. And God comes that close in the person of his Son. We can see the heart of the Father in the face of the Son, as H.R. McIntosh said, and I was quoting the other day. And the reason we should be serving God with reverence and godly fear is appended in verse 29 here, as it was in 24 of Revelation, of Deuteronomy 4. God is the consuming fire. Now let me draw it to a close. I've got a lot more to say, so talk longer than all the week. Sorry. You can think of God as consuming fire two different ways, and you'd both be right. God's holy fire, burning fire, can be thought of in two valid ways that must be held together, if you think it's going to be right. First of all, you can think of God's purity, holiness, and beauty being expressed in this fire, and it can be a fire that doesn't destroy. In Exodus 3, it speaks of Moses saw this burning bush, and yet the bush was not consumed. God's pure, holy fire, in terms of it, the beauty of his spotless character, is non-consuming those who worship him in reverence and in godly fear. I'm going to read you a little bit of a hymn from the often sung in the Church of Scotland by Faber along this side of the holy fire that doesn't consume but purifies you and lifts you up like the burning bush. God is saying to Moses, my people will not be consumed by what we're going to go through because I'm going to be in them with the holy fire. Right? This is Faber. My God, how wonderful thou art, thy majesty how bright, how beautiful thy mercy seat in depths of burning light. How dread are thine eternal years, O everlasting Lord, thy prostrate spirits, day and night, incessantly adored. O how I fear thee, living God, with deepest, tenderest fears, and worship thee with trembling hope and penitential tears. Yet I may love thee too, O Lord, almighty as thou art, for thou hast stooped to ask of me the love of my poor heart. How beautiful the sight of thee must be, thine endless wisdom, boundless power, and awful purity. And in the sense in which I took it to the book of Revelation chapter 8, where the angel takes fire from the altar and puts incense in the censer and then sprinkles it over the prayers of his people. That's the holy fire coming in our prayers to purify, to purge, to make beautiful and fragrant that our very prayers, the fire of God gets in them and reaches heaven, and then the other times of fire come down. That pure, beautiful, holy, non-consuming, non-destructive, uplifting fire. That's one aspect of God's character. Our God is a fire. Then there's another aspect of the holy fire of God. And we're given that he is a consuming fire. You know, one time Nadab and Abihu took strange fire, and fire went out from God and burned them up. God can be a consuming fire to that which is contrary to his character. He must be. He must burn up that which is ungodly and hateful to him and destructive to human life. God must eventually, because he is holy, burn them up. Let me read you just one verse. About time to close. Revelation 19, verse 20. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image worship. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire, burning with brimstone. Some people, some preachers, for whatever reason, won't ever preach on hell, but wait a minute. It's in the Bible. Read Matthew 25, the words of Jesus warning us to flee from the wrath to come. Flee the fires of hell. Hell is real and goes on for those who reject God and reject the gospel and will not serve God in reverence and godly fear, and instead substitute, whether it's idols or celestial bodies or evolutionary process, whatever, in place of God. If they turn not from that, if they give themselves to the images, as it says in Revelation 19:20, they leave God no choice but to cast them into the lake of fire. And the lake of fire burns on because God's purity is eternal. The sweet, beautiful brightness of the morning of heaven and the beauties of the resurrection will always be fresh and lovely and fragrant and wonderful and a constant delight to God's people because God is eternally pure and holy. Heaven is maintained in its wondrous integrity because of the continuing purity, transcendence, and holiness of God. Hell is maintained in its awful reality for those who will follow idols instead of the one true God by the same holiness of God. And we're alive today and we have a choice. What a blessed people we are on this earth.